So it's Wednesday, November 4th, 2015, meeting for the Developmental Disabilities Advisory Board. And it's 5:15, and our first order of business is to get any community input. Does anyone have any community input today?
I brought
Darla.
Oh, Darla, no, sorry. I brought invitations to the legislative reception that's going to be held in Olympia. Thank you so very much. In January, to share with you.
All right, and then David has something to do.
Annually, the governor of the state of Washington puts out an awards program, and this year it was My Disability is One Part of Who I Am. And it's somewhat similar to, you know, our local event in that you can nominate various businesses. So Employers Overboard nominated SCH America for all the people that they've employed. And they didn't get the award, but all the nominees were honored. And so Rosemary from our organization and the representative from
SCH. They didn't get it?
They didn't get the actual award.
Darn.
But they got recognition. Mm-hmm. SEH sent representatives up to the conference that was at Microsoft in Redmond. So, and this is the pamphlet or the program.
So who won?
I'm not sure. Obviously not the right
organization. Yes, exactly.
Yeah, it doesn't appear that the life of that Eva Cheney is here. Mm-hmm. I don't know if she didn't know how to get here or what. We'll put her on for another time. I'll call her. And maybe this is a place. Yeah, we can have. This is a place where Jennifer, who's the housing coordinator for the you can introduce yourself and
yeah, sure. Hi everybody. I'm Jennifer Mathias. I'm the new housing coordinator at the Arc of Southwest Washington. First, I wanted to thank you all for supporting this position. I'm excited to continue the work that the home group has already done, and I'm looking forward to collaborating with the individuals, families, organizations, and to broaden the speakers and topics so that we can get more people attending our meetings. So, thank you.
Did you want more people on your mailing list? Is that what you
We'd like more input and from organizations and other groups in the community, and also other families that we haven't connected with.
Sure.
We would love for them to join us and collaborate and network.
Okay. We kind of worked hard to get her on, so we really want to use her as much as possible, so it's really nice to more as many people know about this as possible.
Okay.
So that, because this is a rare opportunity, we don't want to lose it, we want to use it. And so we need to get people the word out there that she is available and her services are available. So
Jennifer, I have a question. Are you working pretty explicitly with families that are kind of actively in pursuit of housing, or are you wanting to work with families that are younger too and start developing that kind of that long-term plan?
The ultimate goal is to work with families maybe between the ages of 16 and up, so they're getting through that transition and they're networking through the families that may be in the process of housing or already found housing, and really connecting them But it's going to take some time, so it's a little bit of everything right now, because it's starting from scratch. So, you know, just getting the word out there and bringing speakers and people in that the community is interested in hearing about, and working towards more inclusion and options for housing.
Is Mr. Stengel here for the developmental disabilities update?
Darren is here.
Oh, thanks for having me, everybody. I'm in case we haven't met, I'm Darren with the Home Disabilities Administration, one of the supervisors of the local DDA office. Mary and Trish asked me to come by and give some updates on DDA and what's going on over there. So that's why I'm here. I'm also a couple things around real quick. Just going to move those around. Talk about a couple different programs that are fairly new and what's going on with them and that kind of a thing. So first one I think I'll touch on would be the we had in the new legislative session and budget, we had a conversion of one of our state programs. We had a state-only program called the Individual Family Services Program. That program was decided to convert to a federal match waiver program. And in the process of doing that, one of the good caveats that came out of it was we would add more people to the program because we'd create some savings to the federal match component of shifting that from the state-only program to a waiver program. So it allowed us to save some more money as we get the federal match out of it. So we are full steam ahead, transitioning people from what used to be the Individual Family Services state program to the Individual Family Services waiver program. So what we were able to do was kind of revamp the program a little bit, change it up, add some new services. The pamphlet is the one that talked about all the different waiver programs. So it'll have some information about IFS waiver and waivers in general. But what we're able to do is add some new services to the program and add more people to the program previously than were before. So they actually gave us funding to add up to 4,000 people over the next couple of years into that program, which is really, really good. Previously, we had a wait list when it was a state-only program that was pretty extensive. People were on there for many, many years, and so we're cleaning up that wait list. We're adding people into the IFS waiver program that wanted new criteria, and it's a new program and service option for many, many individuals that previously didn't have service or are new to DDA. So, like I like to say, is the door's open on that program. When you come to the front door, it wasn't previously, so we've just made some changes to it.
So is the wait list now gone?
Almost. Okay. Yeah, almost eradicated.
So when is it then easier for somebody who is on an IFS waiver to move over to a 1915C waiver for their, like the employment and other kinds of things?
Presidential.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, once you're on a waiver, it is easier to move from one to another. There's more upfront work when you're first going on through a waiver.
Right.
Working with a client and the family to make that all happen. But yes, once you're on, it's a little smoother within the system to shift from one to the other depending on what your needs are.
And Community First Choice isn't the same as the IFS.
I'll talk about that in a second.
Oh, okay.
Mm-hmm.
All right.
Yeah. Yeah, so program through band, some new services, and it's going well. We're kind of getting people in, so it's a new program that people are coming to Fort Dillon, they can ask about, and we'll talk more about it. CFC is the other one Mary just mentioned on that SAT one pager. That's also new for us, started in July. With also something we work closely with CMS and the feds on, and converted what was formerly our Medicaid personal care program, and that's a program where a caregiver comes into your home and helps you with your activities of daily living, supports you around that. So we converted it to a Community First Choice program. Also, it created a saving. That was one of the main reasons for doing it. Some additional savings for our budget and the department. And that also ties into a little bit of being able to have more people into service. So we revamped it, used this program, got some new caveats to it, such as, flyers, I don't know if there's any more left. Just, yeah, for a minute, thank you. So, so the same thing remains as far as it provides hours of support in a month for a caregiver to come in and provide your support around your activities and daily living. So that hasn't changed. That looks the same. But it has relief care, which is sharing those hours with a different provider to provide you some relief. So if you're the main caregiver, you're not having to do it all. We also have skills acquisition. So if you want a particular provider that can help not just focus on complete activities of loving, but also be able to help you train and be more independent. So we have contractor providers that will work and focus strictly on that with you. And that's a new component to Community First Choice. We also have a component where there's some assistive technology. We have a small amount of money that can be utilized kind of for like a one-time assistive technology. And we can access that and use that money to help help them get their hands on it. And something that's going to help them be more independent. And then we have the personal emergency response system. So we have a piece of the CFC program that allows people to get access to a PRS system. And then also, if somebody's transitioning from institution or nursing level facility, we're going to help with some of those costs from moving from one to the other. So before, what's really cool about CFC is before it was just caregiving hours. Now it's caregiving hours and these other components too. So it's also a really good positive change for programs for our clients to access. So that's a new program. Just started in July, and we're worked on transitioning people from Medicaid personal care to the CFC program. And it's starting to see some people access some of the additional areas of it.
This brochure you have, waiver eligibility, is that for any waiver? And which of these is under which one? For example, is the Basic Plus and IFS, which of these services is each?
So the way it lists out the brochure, it will talk about all the general waiver categories, and then it will tell you, like, these are specific to this waiver, like CIBS waiver, IFS waiver, and it will tell you those categories underneath that topic that will say these ones are specific to this one. Rest of them are fairly generic ones that, for the most part, are eligible across the different waivers.
Why do you have pre-vote services in there?
Because that's a general...
But they shut the front door, CMS
agreed
to that.
Yeah, it's still a service option. I don't know if new can get into our app. I'm guessing not. But, I mean, this county is not an issue.
It's not an issue here, but yeah.
And I don't know when exactly that brochure was
September.
Possibly.
So that's odd. But it would be, I guess, random with that. Okay.
Let's see, what else? Transition students, so we've got transition students, the 2015 transition students. Once again, legislative did give us budget to work on getting them into employment support services if they so desire. So we've got 51 out of this county this year, so we're working on transitioning them if they're interested in moving into the Basic Plus waiver and employment supports. So that's an ongoing project. We just got started in August, and we're looking at getting them all in and working on them, and if they're interested, the door's open. So
you
so
know how many are authorized?
Say again?
How many are processed?
We've got about 41% of the list complete.
With authorization?
No. Complete, meaning they've met and either an authorization or they're not interested or something like that. We've got 41% of it done.
Do you have an idea of how many of those are authorized? I mean, like,
no.
How many of those are authorization?
I don't know.
Ballpark?
Yeah. that's up of, you know, are we at an end point with client A, client B, client C, you know, on the transition list.
Do people fully understand what it means to sound that interested?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. We're advocates for employment.
Yeah, so. I know you are. I was just thinking of all the, you know, because the door isn't always open.
Correct.
And when you're 28, the door is less likely to be open than when you're 21. Mm-hmm. So, wow.
And I'll probably talk with you, Trish, more about that. We can break down that on Friday night together.
Mary?
Yeah.
Can you give a quick description of assisted living facility?
Assisted living facility. Well, we don't have any assisted living facilities in this community.
Okay.
So there isn't any sort of example or other point here locally. Some other areas have assisted living facilities. And then that's actually out of my realm of, like, okay, trying to give you an image of what it is.
Well, if it's related to this, that's probably with senior services.
Yeah, CFC is an open period, yeah. Public community services.
This
as
is
well.
Also for seniors.
So they may be accessing it through them.
And how many people would expect to get services through the community of first choice?
It's a pretty big program. Basically, if you have Medicaid or Apple Health, it's open to you, so, which is...
So if
for our clients, so that's a huge percentage.
So if I had a loved one that was Medicaid eligible, they could then look at these services and the likelihood of them getting in that in how long a period of time?
Likelihood they're going to get it is going to be extremely high, and okay, then timeline from the point that we start conversation, it just depends on, you know, maybe 30, 60 days to get started.
Okay.
Yeah. There's contracting too, and you know, who do you want to be your caregiver? So there's some things that go into that. Extend that. But like we were just mentioning, you can get that either from us if you're meeting a client, or if you're elderly or have physical disability or something like that, through home community services.
So there, that brings something that Darla will talk about, but the business manager in his region, when I saw her last, she said that she would have 40,000 individual providers are needed in the state of Washington. Being seniors and people with disabilities, but even with developmental disabilities, people with mental illness, people with, you know.
So 40,000 people providing these individual services.
You could have, or they could go through an agency, but then the agency needs staff. So that's a big number.
Provider, are they able to fill that number? No,
I don't know.
Provider development is a long-standing concern and struggle to have enough providers, and that's both just individual and professional providers too. It's always a challenge.
Okay, I have a follow-up question to ask. I have a child that is home with me, and I provide personal care. We are exploring what are the options in case I get called away to my home in heaven. And that's perfectly acceptable, living in your home. I talked with the case manager. What if we had the same exact arrangement, except it wasn't me or another family member living there, but someone else? And he said David wouldn't qualify. Is there some crazy definition here that would exclude that?
No, not necessarily. I think you and I and him or the case manager would have to get more in depth on kind of what we're looking at and what that would look like, because we do have some models of support that would look like that. Depending on whether at this exact moment he's eligible, it might have to look into that more. He may have to go through the process in our system to gain eligibility for that type of model.
He's already at his basic level.
So,
but that That was the statement that we could apply, but most likely would not.
Yeah, and without the context of the conversation, you know, I don't know exactly what he was referring to.
I know.
But I wouldn't say that that's a dead end. That's something that we can have some more discussion about for sure.
To me, if that's the case, it seems like there's a problem somewhere in the system that another individual couldn't live in that same house. Mm-hmm. With him living in that same house, mm-hmm. everything else is the same. Mm-hmm. They're providing the same services that I provide. Mm-hmm. And if that's not allowed, that's a problem to me.
Well, and I don't think it's not allowed would really be anywhere in the frame of reference as far as, you know, what it, because that kind of model is allowed. It just depends on, is he eligible, budget impact, that kind of a thing, because the service would not look exactly like CFC if David was living on his own and there was one other non-family member caring for him. It would be a different model.
But he wouldn't be on his own.
Correct. Yeah, but it would be a different residential model we would have. So there are other factors, budget, capacity, other things that come into play when we have residential models like that. But as far as, is it not an option, no, that wouldn't be the answer.
But you might want to call Darren and meet with him, because you don't want it to be a crisis. You want it.
No.
You're trying to plan ahead, which is what you'd prefer.
Sounds like Bill's trying to plan ahead, be proactive. And,
right.
So, yeah. Well, I think you need to get there to talk about.
There are, you know, obviously there are factors that bring all of this to mind, and, mm-hmm. and David's asking the question. Mm-hmm. So, to me, there's a problem with the system if you can't do it that way.
Well, I don't think the answer is actually can't. So, okay. So we can drill down to that.
Okay.
Are criteria, I mean, are they public domain? Is there a place to look up criteria for stuff like that or not? Is that just up to the case manager?
That's a good question. DEA stuff is, you know, all on our website for public. To be a client, there's information for waiver eligibility stuff that's, you know, all public. So that information, yeah, I think some of what Dell's getting at though is not necessarily that service level stuff that you would find in the document necessarily sitting on the web page or something. It's more of that process and system and making sure we're looking at the need and then our process of getting to that point.
Is there a barrier? You don't think there's a barrier for you that we need to get out of the way? Okay. Because if there is and you think that can be part of the legislative agenda. So
you're talking big picture barrier.
Yeah. Is there some
potentially.
Okay.
I mean, and I would think one of the first ones to be in mind would be budget.
Well, no, okay, we got the budget part. We know about that. But is there
but I need more budget.
Other structural is there other structural things that
No, I don't I would not in? Anticipate it. The little bit I have in this conversation so far, I would not.
Okay, so we don't need to go do something to help you change policy.
No, probably can give us more money and then we'll be good.
Okay.
Well, how would that affect budget if I move out of the house and someone else moves in and does the exact same thing that I do?
Because it sounds like a residential model we have as an expensive residential model. I'm not sure without some
discussion. No, it's not any more expensive than the other ones, is it?
Yes, it is.
That was your own fault when it started.
Sounds like a
you'd be paying them the same thing you're paying me.
Yeah, companion home is cheaper than a residential model.
If you look at the state, models.
Well, right, but yeah. If you look statewide, it's cheaper than any other 24/7 model.
Yeah, well, I think what Dell's coming from, he's thinking from the just regular Medicaid personal care kind of model.
Right,
so
but you could do it that way too. You could go at it different ways if
you
know what the need was.
Mm-hmm.
I think it was almost like a different kind of companion model that's got a lot of potential when you're talking about aging families. If we need to create something, why not? Companion homes were kind of created here, so.
So, can I ask a real basic question? Okay, Dell's here. He's able to directly ask you some questions. And he, at least, has been working under a totally different set of information or knowledge or understanding. Whether or not from the context is misunderstood or whatever. My question is that another parent or another family member that doesn't have the direct access to ask you a question or isn't part of the group right here, they may have heard no, and so they just kind of turn around and kind of shuffle off and not understand why. It doesn't make any sense to them. Is there a mechanism for that individual that isn't connected to be able to say, you know what, this doesn't sound right. I can turn to X to be able to advocate on my behalf to clarify, if need be, maybe either misinformation or misunderstanding or whatever it is. Is there something like that in place?
Obviously, a misunderstanding could happen in any context, right. And so that's, I think, that's a pretty typical scenario, but I think that, you know, we do a great job of trying to educate our case managers so they have all the knowledge when they're communicating with clients and families around, you know, what options are and how to access them or not. And, you know, any client or family can, you know, call us, email us, and that's beyond the case manager. They can get to another individual, another level, whether that be me or what.
So do parents, advocates, or whatever know what that due process is? I mean, it's one thing to say, and I'm a bureaucrat. I've been a bureaucrat for 40 plus years, okay? And I can CYA better than anybody in this room times 10, okay? I know that part of what I do to CYA myself is make sure that the people that I say no to or maybe to or yes to, it doesn't matter, that they know what their due process is so that when I get called by the FTA or whoever it is, they can say, have you informed these folks of what their due process is? My question is, is there that same process that when a person like Dale or myself comes in there and gets information that doesn't seem right, they know either by something they're given in the packet of information or by any other means, an ombudsman type of program, that they turn to them to ask the clarifying questions to get better understanding. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. We have, every time we go to the services, we'd be like you were, we've got a pack of information that you get, okay. A couple of those pieces are the what, who, where, why, uh-huh. That information about where can I go to contact, get additional information. We've got the client complaint policy that's in there. So they're getting that information.
So there's information in there that says this is the appeals process. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and when we make a decision, every decision we make, of course, has a appeal process. And that's actually very clearly lined out in the notice.
Okay. Yeah. Thank you.
Yeah.
This kind of thing, I think, is really critical because to me, it's starting to think more out of the box than we have. And I think that it has some real merit that needs to be looked at because housing, I know, is so tight. Mm. And if we can figure out something that's going to be cost neutral, so to speak, I think that really needs to be looked at.
Yeah.
I know.
Yeah. It's just why I'm glad to have resources like this.
Yeah.
So thank you.
And if we can help get things out of the way for you, mm-hmm. besides the budget. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Because you can't go do it.
No. Mm-hmm. Yeah, we rely on our partners just as much as you guys rely on us.
Right.
So it's good that we're working together.
Can I ask, you know, who do we thank in our heads or publicly for this being able to clear this whole waiting list? Is that the federal funding or what? Is that federal funding? Why all of a sudden, where has had all this new money come that you're able to finally address people who are on the waiting list?
Yeah.
The legislature.
The legislature and the advocates.
But is it federal funding? Or is it so?
And the advocates, the ARC and
so DARPA,
parent coalition.
Because
right.
So, mm-hmm.
It's millions of dollars, isn't it?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Right, and it was done very so that it wasn't because we got additional federal money.
Federal money, yeah.
And we're able to move some money mm-hmm. around mm-hmm. and save some 6% on. Mm-hmm. There was this window of time that we got an additional 6% of federal match.
Starlet.
So can we, as an advisory board, say thank you on the record to those people who helped?
Well, to all the people who went to Olympia to advocate,
right.
All the families and the self-advocates from across the state who took time off work and everything else and gave up one of their days to go talk to their legislators or met with them here in their own communities, as you guys did, right? It took everybody working together to get the message through.
It was a couple of years ago that it started to move because my son had been frozen on it for 10 years. Hmm. And I got this call and I almost fainted.
It's been a decade since I went there and got on the list. But, so it's really nice.
We need to thank people.
That might be something when you meet with legislators this year that you can add to your list. Thank you.
And it's a huge letter for suddenly on case management. There's a volume issue.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
Right. And I
but it's exciting because
it's a good,
somebody comes to the door and knocks and we can open it all the way.
Right.
Sorry. So it's even though, yes, more work next door. It's really nice.
It's a much better problem to have. Than
yes.
Right. But I'll continue to ask the transition.
Any other question?
What, and I don't know the percentage, but I mean, with working with families coming out of education, are you getting most of them being open to housing and things like that, or what? Because I know I'm tired, but I used to talk, and then there was no money. But now, hopefully, those families are listening and knowing that there's something available or potential.
Yeah, I mean, we're getting out to the schools as much as we can, partnering with DBR and the family members, and trying to spread the word. And yeah, I think, I mean, I don't think I have enough of a historical perspective to say whether it's necessarily growing or not within the parent population, hopefully.
Would you be able to help the managers, like, note what school district or people don't want to be on the waiver or getting a job or something like that? Because it could be an issue with what they're doing, what's happening at school. And some buildings are better than others at being really proactive around housing and employment and a full life and, you know, all those things. And then we need to work with the ones that aren't, so that families aren't retreated to bedrooms, and you have to deal with the commissioner now in a very different way. But if they have any time to just make a little, if they know the buildings even better, but if they have a district, that's good enough.
Yeah, I mean, that's a possibility. I think we can collaborate with you too.
Sure.
We share that, so.
I
mean, we probably can find that information. There are a lot of variables. It's not necessarily going to definitely be school scenario and why, but there may be a pattern.
We just want to make sure there is no pattern.
Yeah.
That it's a random family situation, not anything to do with anything that's going on outside of. Because I would not expect any of that right now. Camas or Vancouver. And I wouldn't expect it from some buildings in it.
I was really surprised that even Special Olympics and there were some people there, probably about just getting out of school. And so I asked them about, so are you working? No. And then they were kind of grumbling. One of them was really dissatisfied with, not interested in the transition, you know, the final years when they're trying to job training kind of a thing, and they just thought that was dumb. And I felt like sitting them down and sitting on them and you know, try to pound some good sense into them, because I don't know what their situation was, but I thought
they're millennials.
they probably didn't have time to worry about a job, you know, busy with their device.
But it does take education.
Yes, it does.
Yeah.
It takes educating the educators.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah, so
those budgets you're talking about.
I put the blame back on family and the school.
You have to raise your child.
Yeah.
To work,
that's
to be independent.
That's
the first. That is the
bar.
Yes. Absolutely. So.
Thank you.
Thank you so much, Sharon.
I have a few cards.
And Eva's here from Life Opportunities Trust.
Hello, everyone. I'm sorry, I was late. I was wandering around all sorts of toddling along in my heels. Not this one. But I'm really glad to be here. I want to thank Darla on the record anytime I can do that. You know, she's why I'm on the governing board. She and Sandy are why I returned into law. She's why I got into estate planning with disabilities as my focus, and why I'm doing special needs trust planning. So it's all from the Arts Leadership Program, another mom in it. Like, what she creates and what she inspires in people is huge.
Join the list.
Pardon?
Join the list.
Yeah.
So how much that cost you, Darla? $20?
$60.
Personally, to my family, for my own children. A unique need, so my gratitude is endless. So I'm here, I'm on the governing board of the Endowment Trust Fund. We were calling it the Life Opportunities Trust, and I think we're changing the name. Excitement there. What we're working on right now is branding. It's taken probably longer than it should to get this accomplished, but I think that's just how these things go. I joined the board, it's almost a full year now. When my first meeting in December, we were going over the contract to hire a company to help us with branding, and now we've had a big report on how that's going to look, and now we're going to move forward with another contract for the actual branding. So we get a logo and all the kinds of things, so we can regenerate pamphlets, paper material, make the website a little sharper. We're trying to get more people to know about it. What it is and what it does for our families as a special needs trust, a pool of trust, and it's a great deal for everyone. It's just that there's not enough people to know about it, and why it's a great deal. So that's one thing we're working on. We're also talking a lot about the ABLE Act, what that means. I just came back from the Stetson University Special Needs Trust Conference. It's kind of the biggie, and a lot about the ABLE Act. And how the attorneys can use it for more, you know, just make the most out of it. We were even grilling, we had folks from the Social Security Administration from that region in Florida, and we were grilling them about how we could use the ABLE Act to get housing without doing a reduction in SSI. And so we're just all trying to figure that out. And so I would love to come back and share more about that as regs or...
Do you do our part of our parent family training series?
Yeah.
So no,
she hasn't.
Who's done? Oh, why not?
We should.
We should, because you're local, right?
Yeah.
Right, I'm here in Vancouver. I'm with Sinescu and Babish. We do lots of things. Yeah. I'm happy to help. Yes, I have several, and I'll leave them right here.
Okay.
So I'm happy to help in any way, anytime.
Well, it's a way to get the word out.
We heard that Spokane is the model. Is that what someone said? Is that what they said at our meeting? It's in Spokane where they have a bunch of people who are buying houses and everything else with these...
With the trust fund?
With the trust funds or with other funds and without having to... that's what Mona told us.
Well, I don't know about that. Not with the ABLE Act, since that's not... Ready to go
I don't know how what the connection is, but remember she said that you have ministers saying that in Spokane, people are buying houses.
Well, there's Home of Your Own. I don't know if that still exists. We should find out, but we can find out. Would you like me to find out for
you? Yeah, because that was a question he had was, you know, what are the tax? Because if you earn money, you can't get SSI, but then you can't get enough money to get a house, et cetera, et cetera. So how does that all work? And I was like, it's helping. How do you make enough to not also go over, you know, when you have to start, you lose SSI? But we were wondering, if that's the law, I mean, I'm a newcomer, how can you ever make enough money to buy a house then?
Well, that's what special needs trusts are for. It's so that you can have more than the resource minimum.
And it's tax-free, or?
No, a regular special needs trust is not tax-free. The ABLE Act is a tax-advantaged option. However, you can only put in the gift tax amount, which is currently $14,000 a year. So the most you can put into your ABLE account, you can only have one per person, is $14,000. It's really, right now the ABLE Act is set up to help somebody who is working, has a job, maybe they want to save a little money and they're going to put some of that in there. And maybe even they might be able to do some of the investing choices themselves and have some independence and dignity with that. To me, that's where I see the ABLE Act having its best use, though we are trying to figure out how we can, as attorneys, use it even more. But right now, that's what it's looking like. So you wouldn't own a house through an ABLE account.
But, let's see, first time home buyer, and home of your own, and if you put all those things together with a trust, with some kind of whatever you can put into it now for a life opportunities trust?
Well, now the life opportunities trust is a pooled trust. You can't own property. They won't own property, but they will give a distribution to purchase real property. And that would be property in the person's name, in the beneficiary's name. And you know, you can have property, you can have a home. There's an exemption for your own home that you're living in. Still have SSI. You would get knocked that first month. And if you're paying a mortgage, that's another issue. But if a trust, whether it's our trust, the endowment trust fund / life opportunities trust, purchased it, distributed for it, any trust, you would, I lost my train of thought, but my point being you can own a home and have and keep your benefits if you're living there. So the other bit of news I wanted to share was that the DDC is no longer going to be the home for the endowment trust fund. I don't know if that's important to you, but
what is the DDC?
The Developmental Disabilities Council that Ed, I'm blanking on his last
Holland.
Name.
Holland,
yeah. So he has shifted, he has requested that his agency no longer be our home. And so we're looking now at the Department of Commerce to be our home. That might be a good thing. I don't know. Change can be good. So that's something else that's sort of come up all of a sudden.
Well, he's in the Department of Commerce, though.
Oh, I'm sorry. I don't know how all the different things work, but he wants us to be separate from him and just supported by the Department of Commerce.
Okay, so another category within Commerce that stands alone, as opposed to buried in there. Okay.
So that's the excitement of what's going on with us.
Can you tell us a little bit more just generally about how the trust works? You said it was a pooled trust and maybe how that differs from a typical trust?
Sure. So there's three kinds of special needs trusts, and one of them is a pooled trust. And ours is advantageous because there's a huge sum of money, so the state of Washington will match the fee to join. So it's $600 to join our pooled trust, and after 3 years, the state will match that. So it's just $600 extra put in there, and the state also matches $150 a year of other fees. So that's just free money. That's wonderful for the beneficiary to have, and that's how that works. They distribute they have an expert group led by Patty Bell of Trust Administrators. And there's, unlike other, there are other special needs pooled trusts. Beagle Burke and Associates, now Beagle and Associates, they have their pooled trust. There's another one called Lifetime Advocacy Plus up in Seattle. But their fees are much higher. Mm-hmm. And so if you call too many times, you get dinged, you have to pay. Whereas our trust with the state of Washington, you can call as many times as you want, and they will patiently explain all kinds of things, and there's no ding for that. It's sort of unlimited customer service. So we need, as we're branding ourselves, we need to let people know about that advantage to us. And it doesn't have a tax advantage, it's just special needs trusts can only pay for things that are supplemental to what you get from your benefits, so they generally don't pay for food and shelter. So other things, like your internet or phone or a vacation or all kinds of other wonderful things that enrich a person's life.
Transportation,
classes, clothing, things you might need. But we're always, housing is always an issue too, and so we're always looking for ways to still do that with that money. But
wasn't there something about if the beneficiary moved out of state?
There is.
That it was kind of, I saw that when my son was really little, and like a preschooler, and we thought about doing it, but then there was this thing about if they moved out of state anymore. Who was I to predict where he's going to live in as an adult? At various points, he's wanted to follow obsessions, you know, to Colorado or wherever, and I didn't know. But I recall reading something about you have to, something where it couldn't work if the person moved out of Washington, or you had to pay money back. I can't remember that.
I had asked about this too, and so I didn't totally button this down, but my understanding off the top of my head is that you can keep the trust and you certainly don't have to pay things back. I don't know if you can keep contributing to it once you're out of state, but I think you get to keep it and keep getting the distributions as up to the trustee's discretion.
Is it true that any match that the state made would go back to the state?
No. Well, here's how this works. So some trusts, there's two kinds of trusts that we have in our pooled trust. One is the type one trust. I think there's one and two. And one is it's your own money. No, one is third party money. And so that doesn't have a Medicaid payback. The trust two type has a Medicaid payback. So after the beneficiary passes on, whatever's left in there goes to pay back Medicaid before it goes to any other beneficiary that's been designated as a contingent beneficiary after death. So if you have third-party money, so like you, for example, as a parent, if you're putting in money for your child, that would be third-party money, and you put it into one of their trust one types, and it would not have a Medicaid payback.
But I'm thinking of when you contribute, the state matches. I think you mentioned that they match to a certain amount a year.
They match the full $600 that you have to pay to get in, and then up to $150 a month for it's like the tax preparation fee. I think is $75 a year, and then another $75 is some other fee. And they match that.
My understanding was that anything that the state matched and covered if when the beneficiary dies or perhaps moved out of state, that would have to be paid back to the state.
I don't know that to be true. I could find it out for you, but I don't know.
In the original, in the early days, the state matched 25 cents to every dollar that a family put in.
That's right.
Okay, and that was true with that amount of money, but there was only so many slots. And those have been used up now for probably at least 10 years, if not more. So so if you have that kind of trust, you've got it. But new people coming in would be receiving that kind of a trust.
Okay, thank you.
And that if once the beneficiary passed away, if any remaining money that was donated by the state as a match, then we go back.
Makes sense.
But it was quite generous. They appropriated money to match, and then they haven't had it since. So.
Yeah. It was like 2003, I think, was when they used the last of those matching funds, or slots. But they haven't used all the funds yet.
There was actually a foundation, a group that was giving people scholarships for the 600 to even jump into the pool trust, but so few people knew about it that I think they only did about 5 or 8 people that they gave the money to, and then they ended up just closing and giving the money back. Yeah, I was really surprised. To me, it speaks to that not enough people know about the trust, certainly not enough people knew about that option, and I'm really looking to see it trumpeted all over the state of Washington.
I'm really amazed. I'm a newcomer, and I'm really amazed because you always hear people are going to America to take advantage of all these things, and you come here and you say, how many people are not taking advantage of all that? It's really kind of interesting.
A lot of families with special needs and adults with disabilities, they struggle financially. A lot of times, both parents cannot work. I've had many friends, have very, very hard times. And so if your family is struggling, and especially in the early years, just taking a second mortgage out for therapy money, if your family is struggling, donating a trust, even if it's a great deal, even $600 can mean that's a huge amount to a lot of families. So I bet just participating based on finances is a barrier for a lot of folks.
Which is why I was so sad upon becoming part of the board. One of the first things I heard about was that they're shutting down this little foundation that was giving away the $600 to people.
If someone is working, that they would start earning a lot, they could put some money into the trust.
Right? It's true, the individual beneficiary could put money in, but parents could put money
in. Expensive, selfish.
Otherwise, if you went into the community and sought a lawyer to start a trust, is it about $8,000 maybe to start a trust? $7,000?
Well, that's what a lot of lawyers are doing for standalone trusts. That's not what I'm going to do for standalone trusts. Mm-hmm. Most parents of normal means are doing a testamentary trust in their will, right? And then, that's a slightly advanced cost for a will plan. But I know somebody that paid $7,000-$8,000 to have a fancy lawyer put something together, and that person could have used this trust.
Yeah.
So
I know that, historically speaking, they would let you make payments on the $600 at $25 a month.
Wow.
So until the $600 was paid out.
If they still did that, then
they're doing that now. I think you have to come up with the $600, and it gets matched after you've paid the equivalent of $25 a month for 3 years. At the end of that, $600 will magically appear in addition to what you originally put in, which is great. But you're right, the original $600 is a bit of a barrier. But the beauty of this also is that we've had, in the past, when people are planning their wills, doing their estate planning, and they think, well, I'm not going to give anything to my grandson or my child who's on government benefits or maybe on government benefits, because I don't want to knock them off. So they disinherit that child, and then they figure, well, sibling will take care of. And unfortunately, that isn't always how that works. I see that. Sadly, when I do probate work, but this is a way that other family members, once you set this up, and grandma, grandpa, whoever, if they're putting in their email will, they can say, everything for Bobby goes to his account with the endowment trust fund when the time comes.
Well, in that case, then who determines when and how the money can be used?
So the trustee is Patty Bell and her staff, and they are expert trustees, and they're with the ARF, and they're very well versed on what it can be spent on. They're actually dialed in with folks at the Social Security Administration too when there's questions and stuff. So they're the experts. I think that I would be, for them to be a trustee is a lot safer than have a layperson trustee.
Are there fees for receiving them? Because professional trustees normally have fees.
Right.
That can sometimes run, thousands.
So Life Opportunities Plus, Life Advocacy Plus up in Seattle, they do, it's a nonprofit, they do a pooled trust like this. It's $95 an hour. So just from start to finish, whatever it is, to help you walk you through the application, it's $95 an hour. You're calling with questions, it's $95 an hour.
And what are Patty's?
Our fees at our trust is the same. It's the $75 is the tax preparation fee because the trust will generally take out a tax form. And then there's also, I can't think of the name of it, but it's a percentage of the total amount in the trust. And it's capped at $75 a year. But that would be a huge sum. And you'll get your matching is up to $75 a year.
So it isn't expensive as it is.
It's the best deal.
Yeah, that is the same.
So to follow up on Larry's question, whoever's the caregiver would make a request for a distribution to Patty Bell and then they would look at that and approve it. So that's how that someone has to initiate it to the trustee.
And also the beneficiary themselves might, depending on how involved they are able to be and interested in being, they might be making phone calls and asking for different things. And, you know, Patty's very good at helping guide that person based on what their total amount is, if it's appropriate.
And when you set up the trust, the person who sets up the trust, the paperwork is filling out. Within the list that Patty says, this is what SSI will allow, right? But it's like, what can this be used for, right? So sometimes it can only be used for like clothing or whatever, or you could say, no, I don't care if they use it for vacations or internet or, you know, whatever. So there is, when you set up the trust, you have a little bit of control over how the funding is used, if you want.
We do a family training series in Vancouver that WISE helps the county put on, and you'd be a great person to have as they get into that life planning stuff.
Well, we used to make Patty come down, but you know, you're local, so.
It's true. I do trust administration. That's part of the work that I do, and advising trustees, especially with trustees as well, so happy to help. All right.
Great. Thank you.
Good night.
We need to start a legislative agenda and have something that, or at least have some talking points that you want to put forward when you meet with legislators in January. And we can't take action in December, so you need to think about it now and at least what you want to say, and I can write things up for
for you, but Darla has a whole bunch of information. So I have everybody's legislative agendas. But not that I'm biased, but I also brought everybody a copy. I didn't bring everybody copies of all of them, but I brought them all to share. But I brought you all a copy of the Parent Coalition's one. And, you know, believe it or not, I'm actually a person of a few words when I'm writing. And we have one priority this year, and that is to address the lack of providers. So as we were talking about providers, there's not enough independent providers, individual providers, to meet the needs. So it's wonderful that we're getting all these families into the individual and family services, but the reality is, many of the families are not able to access those services because they can't find providers. Our residential providers, we have people sitting in the institutions waiting to come to the community, but residential providers can't take them because the turnover is so high and we can't get enough staff in the residential homes. We have got Medicaid to pay for ABA services, but we can't get enough ABA providers. I think employment is probably a little bit better than some of the other things, but just there is not enough workforce to meet the need for provider issues. And with developmental disabilities in our field, the wages are so low, really a person could go work at a residential home or they could go to Taco Bell and they would probably make more money at Taco Bell. So we have a problem.
Okay. What would this statement be to the legislator to address the lack of providers?
Well, several things. As Darren said, budget is part of it, right? Okay. There's, with the independent providers, there's some training requirements that we passed legislatively. A few years ago, y'all remember when we did that, and they said that everybody's going to have all these great trainings. Well, now what that has cost us is any college students that are working or even high school students, because you have to be over the age of 18, right? As long that are wanting to do spring break, winter break, summer break, right? No, they have to go take this enormous amount of training, and they're not qualifying to be IP providers. So one of our statements is, it sounds great in DDA's paper, but it's not really a service if you can't get it, right? So we've done really good at making this list long, but now we have nobody to actually provide the services. And so that's where we've got to get. We've got 28 people today sitting in an institution that wants to be living in the community, and we can't get them housing. We have funding for them, but we don't have providers to serve them.
I guess where I'm missing the mark is we have Legislator X right there. I'm basically asking Legislator X to do something. Are you saying that we want Legislator X to help us repeal the requirement of additional training that we saw the unintended consequences for? Yeah, that's what I'm struggling with.
That was an SI, if you remember, it was an SEIU union came into Washington first, and they were going then to go to many other states to kind of tie up the training. There was training before they got here, and so at least they have to have some reason, because you're missing, if you're missing college students, you're missing a cream of the crop kind of young person to do some of the
support.
Right. So there's several different things we're going to be asking them about. Okay. One of them, so to answer your question directly, I'm working on a piece of legislation that would say, can we repeal... Remember last year we said if you work less than 300 hours, you don't have to do the 72 hours of training, right? Well, now we're trying to do, if you work less than 300 hours in a year, can we just have you do the safety training, the evaluations, the background checks, those kinds of things? Is there a way that my niece, who's an RN, can go maybe take a test and test out of some of this training, right? Because there is right now, there's no exemptions for testing out of SEIU's training. So we have professionals that have really a much higher level of training that are still, if they want to do this kind of work on the side are having to go do that. Mm-hmm. We're working on how do you, on the behavioral supports, the ABA, we're working on that on a different piece of legislation. And the residential providers are looking at wage increases because that really is going to be a wage increase. So this I have as one priority, but we're attacking it in many different ways.
So what's the wage priority?
Well, the wage priority for residential, let's see if I've got there. So it's Community Alliance. Okay, provider residential provider wage, minimum wage increase. This is a huge problem in King County because of their $15 issue. After the recession, benchmark funding for direct support staff and supported living was cut by 3% in 2009 and 1% in 2011, legislatively. Community residential program have a turnover as high as 43% in some settings, largely due to low wage. In spite of the wage increase in 2015, because I think they ended up getting...
They have to absorb that with insurance.
Well, they absorbed most of it with insurance. I think the direct providers ended up getting, I want to say it's like 16 cents an hour or something increase. Okay, DD residential providers are going out of business and unable to take people because of the already low wages and the wage increase ahead. So that is a huge problem that residential providers are working on across the state. I think self-advocates are working on it. Many counties are working on it. Right. What Parent Coalition did is just roll it into the one bigger issue. But so this is what I'm reading off of is King County's agenda. Do you want me to go on to the next thing? It says the workforce shortage, individual providers and other professionals, there are not enough people willing to be individual providers. Washington State is 42nd in the nation in fiscal effort providing support to individuals with developmental disabilities. Unreasonable training requirements have caused a huge turnover in part-time providers. As a result, families are not able to hire the staff, receive adequate respite, and then they go into crisis.
Okay. To me, that kind of goes along with what we've done. We've got the people working, but now they want to live, but that's not a possibility because you can't get the people to serve them. So to me, it's kind of...
Well, and I love like the conversation earlier. How do we look at what's already in existence? Mm-hmm. How can we take the programs that are already there and create a win-win situation? And Dell has come up with a beautiful idea to do that,
In regards to the training, I can say from experience that the training, just for myself, a lot of it was still totally irrelevant to my situation. Now, if the person's going to be dealing with a person who is very physically disabled, then some of those things, but how to help them get up, how to help them stand, how to lift them with a hoist and move them over and do the bed, you know, change the bed, you know. a huge percentage of the people that need personal care, the caregiver doesn't need all of that kind of stuff. So I don't know if it would be hard, I suppose, to cater the training to the individual situation.
Well, there is parent-provider training just for the parents, and historically I had done that training down here, and Sandy did it before me. So since mid-90s anyway, Sandy or I have been doing that training up until a year ago. Actually, January was the last class I taught. And I chose to walk away from that training. And in doing so, I'm now finding that instead of hiring another trainer in our community, they're sending our families to Snohomish County for training.
Snohomish.
Or Keene or Spokane, or wherever the training happens to be.
On whose dime?
On the family's dime. One of the notes that I had made when you guys were talking earlier is to reconnect and see, okay, is that something that Parent Coalition locally can take on again? Will they allow us to take it on? We had walked away from it for several reasons, but One, just because my plate's too full. Mm-hmm. And but that's, I can't have my family's going to Snohomish County. That's not okay. So we have to work
David. David's
got it. Can I just ask a question? I could be really off the wall, but it seems to me that you're not going to grow social service agencies when you're paying people $12.
Yeah.
And the bottom line is, I mean, we get people from residential because we start people at $14. But if you're paying $12 an hour, it's hard to grow a business and hard to keep staff.
It's hard to.
One other issue, well, two other things, sorry, that I want to, three other things, sorry, that I really want to address with you guys. Another thing that is not a huge problem in Clark County, because we have Mary, but is a huge problem around the rest of the state, is the birth to three. With the birth to three funding that comes, when it gets to the school districts are allowed to take any percentage of admin they want. Some school districts in King County are taking 49% of that funding as admin. So the amount of money that's getting to serve the babies is really low. So I know, it's really, I know. So the birth to three administrative holdback for school districts. School districts throughout the state receive state money to provide birth to three early intervention services. Each district decides for itself how much it will take for admin purposes, ranging from 10% to 50%. How much is being lost? Approximately 30% of toddlers in Washington State exiting early intervention do not qualify for special education services provided by the public school system at age three because they've gone through the birth to three and no longer need those extra supports. In one service area, a birth to three service area's graduates save the district and the state more than $10 million each year. That's just in one community. And so if we look at the amount of admin that's being held back and those babies that are not being served, it's costing us as a state a huge amount of money. So that's one topic I want to bring, just put out there for you. The other one is we have our state-only employment guys, right? That's still a problem. We need to address that. They're always wanting to cut that state-only dollars. And although we've tried to absorb as many of those individuals as we can into one of our waivers, for individual reasons, there's, and Mary and Trish can probably tell you how many of our local guys are state only. So we have like eight,
ten.
So we need
they're hoping, I mean, their budget says they need to get down to from 400 to 70 statewide. Hmm. And sometimes people don't qualify for the waiver because, like one of the guys at CTRAN, he'll never qualify because of his income, which is great. And the DDA wants to save that state-only money for people like him and for people who are in between getting on the waiver. When a young person is making application, they can put them briefly in state-only so that an agency like David's can work with.
And so it's a holding?
Well, it's kind of, they can use that money, and then it's not long-term expenditure on it. It's like a one-time only for 60 days while they're processing paper. So they'd like to get to the point where they have only that, and it's always dangerous that the legislature, because it has no federal dollar attached, they want to sweep it. Mm-hmm. And there are some people who would rather take state-only money than have any services. And I question whether some of the folks are doing that because they're in such financial straits themselves.
And on that note, this kind of ties back to the provider issue. So as Darren said, we've addressed most of the waiting list. That's the waiting list for individual and family services. That is not the waiting list for DDA services.
Oh.
So I am a parent, I have a child, I go apply for DDA services, and they say you're going on a waiting list. Okay, if I don't know to ask and say I want to also be on the individual and family services waiting list, then I'm not on that waiting list. So where we had 15,000 over here on the big waiting list, we only had like 5,000 on the individual and family services waiting list. So yes, this smaller waiting list is getting honed down pretty good, but there is still a significant waiting list of people waiting for services. And as we're seeing, and this is going to come back and hit us in employment, when families are going into the individual and family services waiver, they are having a choice of going on the waiver or getting at what's called SSP, which is a direct cash payment. Families, because there are no providers qualified to use the waiver services, families are choosing to get the direct cash payment, and then they can hire the teenage girl next door, and they can at least use their service to actually get a service. But what that means is they're now not on a waiver, they're not going to get employment dollars later on, and then when they become 21, they choose between losing the cash payment or going on a waiver, and they're choosing to stay on the cash payment. So it's a much bigger issue.
Which will all come.
That answers your question.
Yeah, I think it's delaying a problem that's going to hit them down the road.
It will. And then I have one other issue that I want to throw out to you, and this is a high priority for me. When we had Senator Zarelli, he was on our forecast council, legislative forecast council, and he did he put transition into the forecasting, but they did it not as a actual, they were going to fund everybody, but as a, not complimentary, but
discretionary.
Well, not discretionary, but just kind of like as a helpful way so that we knew how many people were coming.
Oh.
But it was temporary. And so this last year, our transition students have come off the forecast council. So now we're not even forecasting transition students to know how many we're going to need for basic waiver services at 21. Right. So that's,
every
to me,
other
that's a huge problem.
Social service in our state is forecasted, like CPS, and they use it to figure out how many staff are needed in some of the social service state. So Joe did put that transition in.
Courtesy.
Yeah, it's a courtesy.
It's a courtesy count. But it gave us what we needed.
And they're not doing, so what you're saying is they're not doing a courtesy count, right?
They dropped it. So we're not even looking at how many transition students we have coming down the pike that we need to fund now.
Why?
Good question.
Well, that seems like a simple request that is appropriate for our legislators.
Yeah.
That doesn't seem to be burdensome.
That would come back and bite them, really.
Yeah, would save them money in the long run if they would figure it out. Mm-hmm.
Right. So
what do we do? Do we need to establish an agenda tonight, or can we wait until January?
You can maybe wait till January. You'll have to be careful how you, I mean, you'll have to know what you're going to talk about. And so maybe what is looking to you like you might want to vote on in the future, like in January?
Well, I think all of these that she has outlined.
The lack of provider. What I have down.
Wages.
The school district admin, state-only employment, you know, just reminding people not to cut that anymore.
Mm-hmm.
Lack of providers and forecasting of transition. Mm-hmm. That's four things.
Yeah, I could go for that. I mean, the problem is having this raised at this meeting and then at this meeting kind of establishing an agenda.
But what I can do is put up the agenda then and you can vote on it in January.
Is it possible to discuss it in the next work session?
No, you have to have it a public meeting.
We
can discuss it.
Discussion, not adoption of it,
right.
Voting on it in January, but is it possible to finalize draft of ideas in
you can
a,
do the ideas in
a work session. Mm-hmm. And it would it make a difference to put on here the we talked about the family training or the provider training that comes from SEIU that we need to travel north. Is there would our local would our legislators have any say in you said you didn't know if you'd be able to do that again work-wise, but
I don't think that's a legislative issue.
Okay.
How much training people have to have,
yes.
Right,
yeah.
Is. But
the logistics of it isn't.
The logistics isn't. Right, that's just something I need to work on.
You need to train another trainer.
Yeah.
Well, and maybe perhaps get SEIU to
yeah.
agree to a trainer locally.
Yeah.
I find that to be disgusting that we're held hostage,
mm-hmm.
something like that, and it just doesn't make any common sense.
I kind of want to remind them that we are part of the state of Washington.
Yeah, exactly.
I mean, that's kind of what it feels
point.
Like.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
You know.
And it was,
do we want people from Seattle coming down? I mean, maybe that's what we need to ask
yeah.
them, and how inconvenient would that be?
Yeah. And that piece is the parent provider specific, which. It occurred to me this evening, again, listening to you talk when you were talking to Darren, that it used to be I got face-to-face with every parent as their kid turned 21, and I'm no longer doing that. So I will go swallow my pride and request to take the training back so that I can serve my families. And hopefully they'll do that. We'll see.
Well, I think it's
the voters. Be more than you, though. I mean,
that's
you know,
if
something happens
train
to you, that's going to happen. I think there needs to be a mentor at minimum,
yeah.
or two, because you probably have enough need for more than two people.
Yeah. Yeah, there's only like four or five people statewide doing the training.
Mm-hmm. Oh,
so,
wow.
yeah.
Which is critical. That is
Why?
Really critical information for transition.
I have more people than that. Training people how to ride the bus here in Clark County. No, I didn't.
There's a big comparison.
I have trained trainers with
yeah.
that are volunteer trainers, and we have you know Veronica and Sean that are paid professionals, and we have other folks. Come on. So.
How much is the union getting for this?
I don't know. I'm sure a lot because they fight hard for it.
It was $17 million at one time, but I thought that was delayed. The people didn't understand what they were voting for
no.
because of the way they write initiatives.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Okay. We talked in our housing meeting about pushing for some kind of housing, right? Mona
mm-hmm.
said it takes 4 years, so you better at least start thinking about it, get it on the back burner at least, right? So, but this year you're thinking this is a more important issue right now.
Because if you don't have the people to support people in housing,
yeah.
then
it's the same thing. This is why
we don't have the.
Seems to be, yeah.
Yeah, we don't have the providers, and we don't have the physical location either. That's our,
mm-hmm.
you know.
Yeah.
So we need
but,
to work on those.
But we need to keep
issues.
That in the.
Mm-hmm.
And it's good you're there. Keep up.
There's probably things you can do in the meantime. Or this isn't a budget year. This
right.
is an off year. So there probably are things, collaborations that can be done during this year with the homeless and housing people.
Right, and I have spoken with
yeah.
them and been in contact with three people over at SHARE and then the Council for the Homeless. And I've also talked to Pam up north. Partners for Housing. They've got a great roommate program up there,
nice.
And she's had some success. So she has some investors that she's working with right now. So it would be advantageous to partner, and she is willing to have us send. You know, individuals that are looking for roommates to her. It is $250, I think, for the questionnaire. But it is extensive and valuable as far as for our community.
Yeah.
You did it, right? There's
yes.
three
people, I think, are
Martha.
Going to leave them too. Yeah.
Yeah, there's so few that have taken advantage of it.
Right, and a lot of that, I think, is because the word hasn't gotten out,
yeah.
And that's why one of the goals is to get more people to come to these meetings and make them aware. And the roommate matching isn't just about, you know, do you like cats or dogs or, you know, it's really about the family values and, you know, working as a team. And
now the Commission on Aging is promoting that too as a way to help seniors that are now empty nesters or no longer have their partner with them as a way to help defray some of the costs. And this intergenerational approach may be helpful too as well. Maybe not, you know. We may have some younger individuals with disabilities that say, I don't want to be around those old farts, but, you know, I don't know if that would necessarily be the case. And there's a way to also energize the person that's older.
I think that if we get creative, that's what we're going to have to figure out. That would help address the provider issues, right? That would help address the housing issues. We could do that with seniors. We could do it with college students who need roommates. I mean, there's lots of ways we can. We just need to start thinking in new and creative ways. That won't be a legislative issue this year. But I think we need, as a community, really to be thinking outside of that box about, okay, what do we have and how do we pull together for what we need?
But the thing is, on the agenda, then you can have other people saying the same thing, right? And there will be creative, hopefully, right? There'll be other people looking, well, how do we solve this? And then
I just don't know if it's something that needs to be fixed legislatively yet. I think we could fix it. What I'm
talking about the conversation,
yeah.
When you get the synergy, whatever.
Yeah.
I guess where I'm coming from is the legislators that represent us in Olympia are also leaders here in Clark County. Mm-hmm. So while maybe there isn't a legislative agenda in Olympia,
yes. Right.
There is a leadership agenda aspect here in Clark County.
Yeah.
So you say, you know, yes, it's not something we ask you to take to Olympia, but we ask you to take to be leaders in your community that you represent.
Yeah, that's what the
Senate
is.
I mean, this is a little bit off, but I mean, they're having preschools in retirement homes. I mean, to me, it's kind of along that line of thinking outside the box, because
exactly.
It's good for everybody. Mm-hmm.
Okay, so we can talk. I'll type these up.
Burn it up in the next work session for a presentation in January and vote.
And if you want any background information,
I'll get that. Yeah. And I think it's always good to tell them thank you and to remind them about jobs and the other, just the whole gambit of a person's life.
Mm-hmm.
To thank them for what they're
doing. Thank you. Please excuse me.
Okay. Well, now we have one thing more.
Nice try. I would like to suggest that we move to the agenda item F, which is nominations for chair for the group. And I specifically want to identify Ted as being a person that would make a great chair.
Yes.
His dynamic leadership, his, you know, the worldliness that he brings to the group. And also the compassion, and being very serious about that. I know one thing that you're concerned about is being relatively new, but that's what we're here to help you with. That's just, you know, my suggestion. If that's something that, in all honesty, you don't feel that you're comfortable with, then I respect that completely.
Well, I would defer to anyone else who would take it.
But I think
Leah has had it once, isn't
no,
it?
No, 2 years. It's a two-year
term. Year.
It's been 2 years. Year
term. Yeah, but it's a two-year term.
Yes.
I'm talking about two terms. I would, you know, you honor me, but I said really, you know, in terms of knowing people, I don't know that many people.
You're asking good questions that we sometimes forget, and I think that's huge.
Well,
and we feel like you would be able to, you'd be able to work with Mary.
We'll be there for you.
I can hold up. I can hold up for her arms.
Yes, yes, there we go.
Well, thank you very much, and I do accept them, but okay. Only one with that you'll help me. Yeah.
So do we need to have
are we voting at this time?
If you're going to vote, you need to do a motion. If you're not,
I so move that Ted be selected as the chairperson for the next 5 years. I mean,
Is there a second?
Or is that 4 to 5 years? 4 to 5 years.
All those in favor?
Aye.
Aye. Any opposed?
Who is the
second?
Every
Mary Davis.
Every once in a while, you guys make bad decisions. But
not as bad as you just did.
Now there.
Please, yes, thank you.
Thank you. I'm serious, Ted. You're great.
You want to do all of these? This was an ambitious agenda.
Guess what? Okay.
So I think I have to leave too.
Okay.
I don't have to.
Like,
so we'll do this in January.
Is that I know I like to hang around with other people. But I think at this point here that I do want to live on my own, I have been working at my job for 10 years now.
Jeez.
And my goal is for me to live on my own and to learn how to do stuff on my own, like taking ski van. Mm-hmm. And I want to start with that.
Good.
So, yes.
That's my goal. So.
Good goal.
Yeah. That is a good goal. Okay. Okay. That was yours. All right.